number for a fast train to Lyon and made Finn run. We caught the train by a hair, boarding as the doors were shutting, working our way through the carriages and sitting in the middle this time. I don't think I'll ever sit at the end of a train again, or in any carriage with only one way out. It was a 6-hour unbroken journey. The chairs were uncomfortable. The carriage reeked of chemical toilet. I have never been more pleased to be anywhere. We slumped and I passed out, waking with a start 20 minutes later, clammy and shaking. Finn was wide awake, still quite drunk, but happily playing on his phone. SNCF did have Wi-Fi. It was while I was asleep, I should say, that Finn tweeted the podcast episode with Dimi's story in it. I didn't tell him what had happened to Zviad until afterwards.
Why did you think he was going to kill us?
He was telling us.
No, he wasn't.
He told us, Finn. The story about Yergi, the bitch wars. Finn blinked hard.
They were just stories.
There's no such thing. I told him about Zviad and the toilet. Finn insisted that we call the Italian police. Zviad might still be alive. We didn't know. But a decade of avoiding the authorities makes you skittish. So Finn called, spoke for a bit, louder and louder, looked increasingly exasperated, and then handed me the phone. The operator didn't speak English or attempt to moderate his heavily accented Italian. I didn't even try to use my broken Italian. I knew the call would be recorded, and it would show us trying to inform the police of the murders of Giulia and Zviad, but failing. It was good. We could use it later to prove that we were innocent. I kept the call going for as long as possible and then hung up. I didn't know they had CCTV on all train carriages and had film of Dimi dragging Zviad into the toilet. I don't think I have ever been so tired in my life. Every cell felt depleted, but I was too wired to sleep. I lay my head on the window and watched the mountains glide by in the grey dawn and missed my girls as Finn played on his phone.
Oh, he said, Anna.
He showed me the Twitter feed. The Dimi episode was already raking in the RTs, but one comment came in every 30 seconds. It was bot-generated, untraceable. It was a photo of my girls. I had never seen this photo. It was the girls in Halloween fancy dress costumes they'd worn to the school. It must have come from someone else's Facebook post. They were grinning in front of the gates with their arms around each other. Lizzie had no front teeth. Same photo, over and over again. The picture was captioned, "Call me, DL. Kiss." Chapter 45. At Lyon, we checked into a bland corporate hotel a mile or so from the station. We got one room. Neither of us felt safe enough to be alone, or sleep, or even lie flat, actually. We were both, in the parlance of the street, fucking terrified. I ate all the complimentary biscuits, stared out of the dirty window and drank watery hot chocolate. When I couldn't take any more and had to walk, we went out. We went to find Sabina's bakery. We walked fast for an hour. It felt good. We were in a posh clothing street off the Place des Jacobins when I saw Finn turn to look in a shop window and the skin on his neck folding in 5 straight lines. He was thinner than he had been when we set off. God, I missed Hamish. I missed his beautiful hands and his flaws and his uncomplicated selfishness. I missed fighting with him about Candy Crush. I missed my face buried deep in his faithless chest and my nose brushing his hair. Here. Finn was staring into a shop window full of beautiful cakes.
Really? I said stupidly, thinking he was hungry. This is Sabina's bakery.
Oh. He took out his phone, fitted the mic,
and turned on the voice recorder. Then he smiled at me, slipped the phone into the top pocket of his tweed jacket, mic sticking out, and walked boldly into the shop. It was a somber room of bare pink plaster, with brightly coloured tiny cakes, pink and green, brown and blue, tiny eclairs and millefeuille, all the classics done in miniature. They were little works of art. Behind the counter were two women, both in white chef jackets. Sabina was blonde and looked remarkably like Emila. We knew it was her immediately, even though we had never seen a photo of her, because she knew us. She crossed her arms and spoke to us in English. Get the fuck out. Oh, said Finn, surprised by the level of aggression. Awkwardly, he raised a hand as if he was waving hello to her on a bridge a mile away. Hi. Out. She lifted the counter and came out, arms wide, shepherding us towards the street. It was a bit frantic. She was moving very quickly, having been in a hot kitchen, and we were sloping about like a pair of hipster bums who hadn't slept were hung over and felt sorry for themselves. Somehow there was a consensus that if she got us as far as the street, we would never have the chance to speak to her again. We resisted. I stood in her foot. She narrowed her lips and turned to me, wide-eyed. Sabina was tiny, I should say, so she was looking up at me at quite an acute angle. She could have bitten a chunk out of my shoulder if she had been so inclined. Emila is innocent, I said. Don't you want her free? She shook with anger. Emila is ill. Emila is very ill and was misdiagnosed in prison. Now it's too late. They can't treat her without killing her, but you don't care about that because it's not in your story. She tried to wiggle her foot out from under mine, but I pressed it harder. What if we can get her out? She stopped. Like a jailbreak? Like prove it was someone else? She snorted, not once, but twice, and whispered, You don't know these people. Gretchen Tiegler? She looked at us, one to the other, and smirked. She'll kill you. She has tried. That got her attention. I softened my hold on her foot. When? Just now, on a train. Two assassins. And before. I lifted up my fringe to show my scar, and she looked confused. Elle est Sophie Bucarin, said the woman behind the counter. Sabina knew the name. She nodded at me, impressed. You do know her then? I do. Finn blurted suddenly. How could you afford to open a bakery? Sabina blinked. I know you didn't have the money before Emila's conviction, but suddenly you do. How did that happen?
Are you accusing me of something?
Finn was too tired to couch it.
I am, yeah. I wonder how it is that you've suddenly got money and Emila decides not to appeal against her conviction.
Sabina laughed bitterly, staring into the street beyond us, standing very still. She snapped back and looked at us.
Come in,
she ordered.
Come in here.
She turned away, looked at my foot, and I released her. She walked back through the space and the counter and waited at the side for us to follow her through to the kitchen. It was spotless, full of new stainless steel appliances and worktops. The sound quality would be tinny and awful, too many hard surfaces. She waited until we were standing with her, and then she said,
I was paid by Gretchen Tiegler, in cash by her secretary. She came here with the money in a bag and told me that Emila should serve her sentence and not appeal and I could have all that money. She opened the bag to show me it. It was a lot. She didn't know it was already too late. We were dealing with bigger things than her appeal.
You took the money?
I did. It made no difference. It was already too late for Emila. She's dying. But at least now, when the courts decide she's nearly dead and release her, I can afford good palliative care. So I took the money, signed a non-disclosure and opened this bakery. She wanted this. We both wanted this. So now I visit Amila once a month, and I send her photographs of the bread every day, so that she can see the morning's work. When I visit her, if it's one of the days when she can talk, we talk about the bread, about the bakery, and the cakes.
If she can talk.
Sabina hung her head. She braced herself and her voice became a whisper.
Amila's headaches. The reason she left the Dena in Saint-Martin were caused by a brain tumor. She is dying. They have operated twice, but it keeps growing back. An appeal will take years. She wouldn't live long enough to go to court. If she was free, she could have had better treatment. She could have traveled for the operation. It might have gone better. But she isn't. She's in prison, and this...
Sabina motioned to the kitchen.
This is what she wants me to do.
So you... She prodded me in the chest.
You tell people. Tell them I took blood money from that bitch. And let her think I betrayed Amila. That her money was enough for me to do that. I let everyone think that. I don't care what you think of me because I have one thing to do for my Amila. I get up at 3:30 every morning and make beautiful bread. And I make it with love for Amila. I take a photo of the bread every day and I print it. And before we open the doors to our customers, I put that picture in an envelope and I post it to Amila because she can't read anymore. But she can see pictures. And every morning I stand at the postbox. And every morning I kiss her envelope and I whisper her name. My Amila is worth 10 of Gretchen Tiegler and my Amila is dying and I am dying too. Now get out of our shop and don't you fucking come back here.
We did. Outside, Finn took the phone out of his pocket, pulled the mic out and put it into its little bag and drew the string. He put it in his pocket.
I don't know if we should use that recording, he said.
I think we both felt very humbled. Yeah, best scrub that. We can tell it ourselves. We walked for a bit. I thought about Sabina, how she was prepared to have people believe her low, the constancy of her love. She could have been lying, but I didn't think she was. Tiegler wielded her power so ruthlessly. She had warped all of our lives. She might have spies here. She might know we'd been to see Sabina. We could have put her in terrible danger just by talking to her, like Julia. Out of nowhere, I said, I can't fucking stand this anymore. I'm going to Paris to confront Gretchen Tiegler face to face.
But Dimi's in Paris, said Finn.
I'm expecting Dimi to be there. We walked on. I expected Finn to say he'd stay or go to his friends in Clermont-Ferrand. He stopped and nodded and said,
Okay, I'm coming too.
On the Paris train, I sent a text to Dauphine Loire. I'll be at the Neuilly Villa tomorrow. Tell Gretchen I'll only talk to her. She didn't reply. Chapter 46. We got drunk again, on a train again, but this was more melancholy because Dimi wasn't there to tell stories. We were scared, and being drunk helped. We were still quite drunk when we got to Paris. I don't honestly know how we ended up in a hotel as expensive as that. I don't know if we took a taxi or what happened. It seems too far to have walked from the station. But maybe we did. I just don't know. There are gaps. But we got there and we saw it was a hotel because a big sign outside said, Hotel. And so we went in. We were drunk. We were exhausted and dishevelled. We staggered over to the reception desk. No one asked us to leave. I have a vague memory of a smirking, beautiful woman explaining the breakfast times to Finn as he rocked softly on his heels next to me. She told us all she had was a sweet. I thought maybe she had confused us with some important dishevelled drunks, but she took our passports, photocopied them, and gave them back.
She called Finn by his proper name, welcomed him, and we were escorted up in the lift by a man. I think it was a man. The suite had a living room with a very big television and sofas with a lot of cushions. The dominant colour was beige. Off the living room was a dining room, and then a door led into a bedroom with a gigantic and inviting bed, a headboard of grey silk, crisp white linen sheets and too many pillows. Finn tried to tip the man who had brought us here, but he refused to take the money.
"I loved it," he said, apropos of nothing.
What? Finn tried to tip him again.
"The train podcast, Dimi, brilliant, thank you."
And he walked out and shut the door. We slept for 10 hours. I can't make that interesting. Of note was the fact that we were in separate beds. I on the couch, Finn on the bed. I had a bath at one point. Later, he had a bath. It's quite boring to hear about, but the experience was glorious. It was lovely to be clean. During the night, a number of things happened without us. The podcast went stratospheric. Most of it was Dimi telling the story of Yergi, and a lot of Finn and Zviad giggling. I've heard that episode since, and I admit that it is compelling. Also, Zviad's body was found in the toilet. He had been strangled. Zviad was 31 and had a wife and a 7-year-old son in Duras. The CCTV from the train was viewed, and Dimi was found and traced to Pigalle a few hours later. He was arrested and charged with Zviad's murder. He was not charged with Julia's murder. His real name was Yergi. This was all unknown to us as we woke up the next morning, late, about 10, and ordered breakfast in our room. A trolley arrived with coffee and fresh croissants and jam, muesli and almond milk. We opened the windows in the dining room and ate with our feet on the table, looking out of the window at the Paris rooftops. If we stood in a chair and bent sideways, we could see the Eiffel Tower. We both felt hungover but calm, until our predicament sank in. I was nervous. Finn could see that.
What are you going to say?
I'm going to tell Gretchen what happened to Leon.
Don't you think she knows already?
I have to believe she doesn't. I looked at him. He was eating cereal with almond milk. The bowl was small, but it was his second portion. I could tell that he was enjoying it. I smiled.
Are you smiling because I'm eating?
No, I'm smiling because I care. It's that addict vortex, isn't it? Everyone around gets sucked in. 2 weeks from now, I'd be crying and banging on the bathroom door and begging you to eat a cracker. He laughed at that, covering his mouth to keep the cereal from going everywhere. He finished his food. He picked up his phone and started to scroll.
Fucking hell. This is out of control.
He showed me the numbers. They were ludicrous, in the hundreds of thousands. This had to be the peak of it, and there would never be a better time to expose Tiegler.
I'm coming with you, said Finn.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am. I'm coming.
I didn't think Finn should come with me. It could go very wrong. The plan was thin and had 3 different factors that could easily fail. We argued for a bit, but he wasn't even open to a discussion about it. I'm coming, was all he would say. He didn't need to. I thought of Julia lying on the floor, eyes fixed on the ceiling. It might not work, Finn. I'm walking into a very dangerous situation. There's no real reason for you to come. If I'm there alone and they kill me, it'll be over. You'll be clear.
I'm coming, he said. I won't let them hurt you.
What are you going to do? Faint at her.
I saved you in Skibo. I'm coming with you.
And he got up and locked himself in the bathroom. That was fair. He had saved me. All I had left to do was talk to my girls. I called Hamish and we had a curt in front of the kids conversation. How are you?
Very well, Anna. How are you today?
Did the move go okay?
Actually, better than could be expected. We got an upgrade, so it was worth doing.
Oh, I'm in mortal danger, but you save a buck. Well done.
Yes, tens of euros, so in the end it's all been worthwhile.
As I said, he can be quite dry. We both instinctively knew not to say where they were, just in case. But Hamish mentioned the journey and a flight, and I assumed they were far away from Porto. I could hear the kids watching TV in the background. He put them on to talk to me. It was all the usual stuff. You don't need to hear that. We were pretending things were okay, so it was all pretty banal, even while it meant the world to me. I kept telling them I loved them and how happy I was that they were having a good time. Jess was talkative. I think she was trying to reassure me that I was still number one. She didn't want to mention Estelle or say anything positive about her to me. I didn't want their future to be all about me versus Estelle. I didn't want that for them. I asked Jess to put Estelle on. She asked if I was sure. I said, yes, of course, we're friends. I was friends with Estelle before Daddy even met her, you remember? She gave the phone to Estelle. Estelle?
Yes?
You know the situation?
Yes.
If anything happens, I want the girls to remember us being friends. Can you cheer it up a bit?
Oh, yes, of course. Of course, Anna. Don't worry about a thing.
Estelle has the same weaknesses as me. Maybe that's why we liked each other. She said, the girls have made holiday diaries to show you, so you know what happened each day. They'll talk you through them when they get back.
There is no word for the realisation that a step-parent cares for your children almost as much as you do. It's a very strong feeling, a great hot soup of gratitude and relief and love.
I didn't hit him, Estelle. I want you to know that. And it was over between us. He's not lying about that. We were struggling.
Okay, then.
She said it for the audience, not for me.
So, where is Finn?
Finn was still in the bathroom. He'd been running the water in the sink for a suspiciously long time. Finn is pretending to wash his hands in the sink, but I think he's actually throwing up his cereal. She snorted at that, and I laughed along with her. The bathroom door opened and out came Finn.
Can I speak to him?
I caught Finn's eye. I don't know if he wants to speak to you, to be honest, Estelle. But he did. He reached forward and took the phone and went into another room. He whispered to her. I don't know what they said, but when he came back, he'd hung up and his eyes were red.
What did you say to her?
Goodbye.
He looked at me.
It's hard to be alive sometimes. Don't you find it hard?
I was worried he meant he didn't care if we were murdered today.
I do, until my life is threatened, and then I'd fight the world.
He smiled.
Fuck it, let's go to Gretchen's house.
Finn, you are planning to come back out of there, aren't you?
Yes.
But he didn't sound convinced. I felt he was planning to do something heroic. Stick to the plan.
I will.
I knew he was depressed and reckless. I knew he was losing weight and I should have left him in the hotel. I let him come with me because I was afraid to go in alone. I'm a coward and a bad friend. We went downstairs. We did not belong in that hotel. The other guests wore dressed-down cashmere sweaters and couture frocks. As we crossed the lobby to the front door, I saw on a tiny plaque on the wall behind reception, the room tariff. Our suite was $6,000 a night.
It almost made me hope we didn't come back. We'd be washing dishes for a century.
Chapter 47. The Tiegler Villa was set back from the street, obscured by a row of trees and an 8-foot-high wall with broken glass twinkling on top. Cameras were perched on high poles at either end. The gate was grey metal, tall and barred with matching sheet metal behind it, blocking the view of the house. Finn took his phone out, put the mic in and turned on the recorder.
"We're at the gate of the villa," he said solemnly. "We're going in to meet Gritch and Teagler. It's a pretty serious gate. 3 big bolt locks, cameras everywhere."
He nodded me to the button. I took a deep breath, raised my hand and pressed the bell. We heard nothing. The intercom was a grey metal box with a speaker on it and a small glass eye. We had to assume we were being watched. Finn nodded me to it and I raised a hand to press again, just as the heavy lock on the gate snapped open. Finn pushed it with his shoulder and we slipped into the grounds. From a drab Parisian street, we found ourselves in another world. Combed white gravel chips framed twin square lawns on either side of a path leading up to curved steps to the door. The building was a 19th century villa, 2 stories and modest in scale, pale yellow with stucco plaster leaves painted green running diagonally across the facade. They were lush and bushy at the bottom, trailing to sparse and detailed at the top. It was quite lovely. The lock on the gate snapped shut behind us. We were trapped. We looked at each other. I hoped I didn't look as scared as he did. Finn took a step forward on the gravel and we discovered that it was not just ornamental. Every movement of our feet echoed around the yard, the sound amplified by the sheet metal gate. We waited. I don't know what we were expecting, dogs or snipers, but nothing happened. Finn's voice was very low as he muttered into his phone mic.
"We're trapped in here. The gate is locked behind us and we're approaching the front of the house now."
We crunched up to the stairs, our steps ridiculously loud in the vacuum of sound. We stopped at the bottom. Nothing happened. We walked up the steps to the front door.
"We're at the door," whispered Finn.
I knocked. We could hear steps approaching inside and the front door opened. A Filipino maid in her 60s, wearing a black uniform under a white starched penny, invited us in without looking at our faces. We stepped into the hallway. From the outside, it looked like a grand 19th century villa, but inside it was pure San Diego, as if the inside had been scooped out and remodeled as an ugly Californian hotel from 1987. The hallway was shallow and wide, 3 small rooms knocked into one, black and white tiled floor and very little furniture. A white marble statue of a headless naked woman stood between 2 sets of double doors. There were no seats. The Filipino lady shut the front door behind us, bolting it top and bottom. She turned back and pointed at the phone in Finn's hand.
"No."
She watched him take the mic out and put it in the drawstring bag. She watched him turn off the voice recorder and ceremoniously put the phone away in the top pocket of his suit jacket.
"Is it recording?"
she asked in unexpected English.
"No,"
said Finn, patting his pocket. She looked at the centimeter peeking out of his pocket, unsure whether to believe him. Finn told her the microphone fitting was at the bottom, in the mouthpiece.
"It can't pick up sound as long as it's in my pocket. That's why I have this."
He showed her the detachable mic and dropped his phone back into his breast pocket. She looked, reassured herself that it was pointing the wrong way, and then turned and walked away through a side door. We waited. The renovations must have included soundproofing because we heard nothing. No muffled steps or radio burbles, no sounds of car engines from the street or jets overhead. It was quite disconcerting. Finn leaned his back against the wall for a moment. He was very pale. Suddenly, one set of the double doors in front of us opened. Dauphine Loire stood there, smiling coldly, dressed in a white wrap dress, patent nude shoes, steel-framed glasses and a silver belt. "Hello," said Dauphine. "Thank you for coming to see us. Come with me, won't you?" She turned and walked down the stairs, inviting us to follow with an imperious wave of her hand. Her accent was no longer Venetian. Now her inflection was fluent Southern Californian. As an observer of accents, she was very good, I'll give her that. We followed her down into a large, airy room with wall-to-wall cream carpets. There was no one in there, just a big TV on a wall and a giant cream sofa. The far wall was a sheet of glass looking out onto a long stretch of lawn. At the end of the lawn, I saw the roof of a glass tourist boat sliding slowly along the Seine. Dauphine walked over to the right-hand wall, pressed three fingers into a square, and a door swung open on the wall. We followed her through it into a stone corridor. It led down and along the back of the house. It must have been subterranean. The geography of the house was quite confusing, but we came through a door into a Victorian sunroom attached to the side of the house. It had been stripped of shelves and seedling pots and redecorated as a sterile space. It was eye-wateringly bright. And there, in the bright blaze, sitting in the centre of a white and yellow striped sofa, was a small woman in a blue dress, steel-framed glasses, her hair up in a blonde chignon. She stood to meet us as we came in, hands clasped in front of her, a signal that she would not be shaking hands. "Hello," she said. "I am Gretchen Tiegler." Chapter 48. We were being offered tea and cakes by both Dauphine and Gretchen. Finn said no, that we'd rather just get on with it, thank you. They agreed that yes, tea and cakes would be nice. Yes, I'll call the maid. It was as if they couldn't hear him speaking. That's how I knew that they were almost as nervous as we were. Dauphine pressed a button on an intercom on the wall and told someone to bring tea and macarons. A voice crackled back.
"Oui, madame."
They were dressed alike, but there was no physical similarity between them. Dauphine was slim and tall. Her legs were long. Gretchen was short and stubby and wide across the hips. Dauphine sat down next to Gretchen and her pose exactly mirrored Gretchen's. She crossed her legs, clasped her hands around her knees. It was extraordinary to watch her smile and respond to Gretchen's every gesture, mimicking, reflecting. When Gretchen looked at me, Dauphine followed her gaze to my face and all the Gretchen-inspired warmth drained from her. I could have been a tree or a table. "I hear." Gretchen's accent was Californian, her voice soft. "That you are investigating my husband Leon's death." I nodded. "In a podcast?" "Yes." "And that you actually met him some years ago?" She seemed to speak exclusively in questions. I nodded. My mouth was so dry, I didn't trust myself to speak. "Well," she gave me a cold smile, "that's nice." We looked at each other, Gretchen Tiegler and I. She had done such awful things to me, brutal things, when I was young and vulnerable, but she looked at me unflinchingly. I wondered how she dared. And she kept looking at me sternly as if I were the offender of the peace. What mental processes did she use to justify what she had done? I couldn't imagine. She seemed to be having similar thoughts about me, though, because we were glaring at each other now. Dauphine interjected, and I knew it wasn't to spare me.
"We have crossed paths before, you and I," she said.
I believe you used to call yourself Sophie Buchanan?
I didn't used to call myself that. It's my name. People change their names, though, don't they, Dauphine? It was as if Dauphine saw me for the first time. She looked at my face, her head tipped, her cheek twitched a curious smile. "Huh," she said, suddenly interested. Gretchen was not interested. My teaser didn't pique her curiosity at all. She just wanted this to be over. Her mouth turned down at the corners.
"I have someone here who knows you."
She glanced at Dauphine, nodding an order. Dauphine stood up and pressed the button on the wall again before sitting back down. They looked expectantly at a door in the back wall. I think I knew who was out there. Why wouldn't they? He was the only person I was scared of. The door opened and the man stepped into the room, presenting himself to the company. He was big, dressed for a fight, badly scarred on his neck and jaw. I would have known him without the white squares of grafted skin on his cheek and jaw. Dark hair, long lashes, narrow chin. For a moment I was back in my mum's kitchen, oil spluttering in the pan behind me, flinching from the sight of Patricia's name on the face of my ringing phone. I think he expected me to scream or something. He had been waiting for this moment. He'd probably thought about me more than I had thought about him. Every time he had an operation, when his scars ached, when anyone flinched at his scars. He had been waiting to meet me again, and I spoiled it for him by not reacting at all.
"Do you know me?" he said.
"You're that oily boy," I said and shrugged.
"So what?
Second time lucky?" He tried a threatening scowl, but it didn't take. What he didn't know was that I wasn't going to get scared. I was already scared and had been for a long time. My blank reaction annoyed him. He scanned the room for someone to frighten and saw Finn, skinny, effete. He turned square to him, expecting at least a cower. But Finn sauntered over to him, stepping protectively in front of me, holding out his hand.
"Good afternoon," he said pleasantly. "Very nice to meet you. I'm Finn Cohen."
Perplexed, Scarface smiled and took Finn's hand, squeezing tight. I noticed he planted his feet carefully, as if he was expecting Finn to try a throw or a punch. But Finn didn't do any of that. He just shook the man's hand and stared into his face. All the women watched them shake hands for too long. It was a peculiar moment, but Finn knew what he was doing. He was getting a good, clean look at his face. When Scarface finally realised that there would be no bouts of wrestling or judo, just a whole lot of handshaking, he let go and shuffled back to the wall, cupped his hands in front of himself, waiting. I said to him, "You and Ms. Teagler have known each other for a long time. Where did you meet?" He looked at Gretchen, who gave a non-committal roll of her shoulder. She didn't really care what anyone said now. We were coming to the end of it. "London," I said, "when the rape case was going on?" They looked at each other. Gretchen gave a little head shake. "The rape case," I said. "The court case against the men who raped me." No one said anything. I could see Gretchen losing patience and squirming. I liked it. I asked Scarface, "Did you kill the other girl and set fire to her house?" He gave a slow blink. "Never mind," I said. "Let's assume you killed her after you tried to kill me. Your blood was all over my kitchen, wasn't it? Bet the police kept some of that." I turned to Gretchen. "I heard you're pawning the stadium in Fulham." She curled her lip. "I don't know what you're talking about." She turned towards Scarface, opened her mouth and drew a breath, on the brink of telling him to get me out of here, but was interrupted by the sound of rattling china outside the door.
"Ah!" Dauphine clapped her hands together. "Tea."
The maid, it turned out, was the Filipino woman who had opened the front door. She arrived with a tea trolley carrying an elaborate China tea service and a plate of multicoloured macarons set out in circles of red, green, yellow. I think Gretchen and Dauphine had been on a diet or something because they were mesmerised by the sight of the cakes. The maid rolled the trolley into the middle of the room, picked up the teapot to pour, but was ordered to leave, which she did. Dauphine stood and poured. Finn and I both realised at the same time that there were only two cups. We were not expected to be here for very much longer. Finn went for it.
We really came here to ask you about the sinking of the Dana, if possible, Miss Teagler. It should only take a few minutes.
Gretchen looked from the cakes to Finn's phone in his pocket.
You're not recording this.
Finn said,
there wouldn't be any point, would there? I think we all know how this ends.
Gretchen shrugged, dispassionate to the brink of bored. Finn ploughed on.
We all know Amila Fabricassi is innocent, he said, that someone else was on board the Dana that night and got off. You have the necklace that should have gone down with the ship. That story about it being posted is tissue thin. There are traces of a Zodiac ripcord in the wreck dive film. We know someone flew Violetta into San Martin, paid for her hotel suite, bought her two dresses in different sizes. There was someone else there, and that person cast the Dana off from the dock. They drugged the Parkers and then left on the Zodiac lifeboat before it sank. They had the necklace with them. They couldn't stand to leave it. But they didn't keep it. They gave it to you.
Gretchen gave a sickly smile. You don't believe in ghosts, then?
Finn gave her one back.
You don't seem very surprised by any of this. I mean...
He stepped forward and did a strange thing. He picked up a bright green pistachio macaron and took a big bite.
Why aren't you surprised?
He spluttered bits of green powder onto the floor.
You know all of this already, don't you?
She gave an incredulous lady laugh from deep in her throat.
Whatever can you mean?
I hated her at this point. I loathed her faux innocence, her decor choices, her bringing Scarface back to frighten me. Leon was no hero, but how could he marry her? How could he stand her? Maybe he needed cash to support his families, but there must have been less disgusting billionaires in his social circle. Someone with a bit of panache or style or a bit of something. Gretchen was revolting. Leon was broke, wasn't he? I said loudly. Did you know that when you married him?
Gretchen sniffed and pursed her lips.
He covered it well.
You were angry when you found out.
Well, I had already married him by then. At this point, I thought, fuck it, and stood up to take a raspberry macaron without being offered. But you were angry enough to withdraw all financial support to Julia. I took a bite. It was gorgeous, so sweet and acid, lemon and raspberry, soft and crunchy that I almost didn't hear Gretchen mutter, I didn't withdraw Julia's financial support. She looked at Dauphine, who leaned towards her, and explained softly,
the lawyers had a problem with Julia's papers. She wouldn't sign the contract. They're sorting it out now. It's just temporary.
Gretchen grumbled. I didn't hear anything about that.
They're sorting it out now.
Finn said,
you could have sent her a suitcase of cash, and waved his half-eaten macaron at the fancy room.
Gretchen smiled bitterly.
Yes, well, other people's money is always infinite, isn't it?
Dauphine is lying, I said. It's not temporary. Julia hasn't had any support for 2 years.
Gretchen frowned, inasmuch as she was able.
What is she living on?
She's fine, said Dauphine dismissively.
She has a house that an old boyfriend lets her live in. It's two damp rooms, I said. Delphine raised a shoulder and told Gretchen, she's happy there.
No, Julia is not happy there. Julia is dead. She was murdered. 2 days ago, she was stabbed repeatedly in the chest. She dragged herself 10 feet across the room, bleeding out, drowning in her own blood, to get a photograph of Violetta. She was clutching it face out on her chest when we found her.
Gretchen was genuinely shocked. Her hand began to shake. Delphine put a protective arm around her shoulder.
Don't upset yourself, darling.
Do you feel bad about that? I said to Delphine. She was wary.
Of course. It's terrible.
No, I mean, just leaving your mother lying there like that. You killed Julia, didn't you, Violetta?
Violetta stood up suddenly and her plate crashed to the floor. Her lemon macaron shattered like a yellow dust bomb. She looked at it, moved to say something but stopped. She looked at Gretchen. A warm, loving smile broke out in her face. But this time Gretchen didn't reciprocate the warmth. She shrank away from her and whispered, "What did you do?"
Violetta ignored her and nodded scar-faced to me, but Gretchen held up a staying hand.
"Violetta," she whispered, "what did you do?"
Violetta turned to her and tried the loving smile again.
"Protecting you, Gretchen. That is all I want to do."
Her accent was Italian now. She sounded like an off echo of Julia's gorgeous drawl. They looked at each other, Gretchen cowering and horrified by what she had heard. Violetta's expression happy and loving like a mother on a Christmas card. Her reaction to Gretchen's shock was wrong, so wrong that it was clear Violetta was fluently expressing emotions she wasn't feeling. I remembered the restaurant in Venice, the eerie sense that she could eat soup or stab me in the face and feel nothing much about either. I carried on, trying not to look straight at Finn.
Julia dragged herself across the room to get a photograph of you. Did you watch her? Did you watch her die? Or were you already busy raking through her belongings, looking for the luggage from Hotel Turak? You couldn't believe she still kept the luggage the hotel sent back, could you? She kept it all that time. But you needed it back because it proves Delphine was there. Her DNA is all over it. It wasn't even your size. That's Delphine's body rotting in the Dana's dining room. You got her to take you to San Martin and Gretchen's plane, to hire the hotel suite for you. They're great friends, said Gretchen. I couldn't stop myself. You are a fucking mug, lady. Violetta has been playing you all along. Was Delphine a bit needy? Was she friendless, isolated because she worked for you, was she?
Gretchen flinched.
Of course she was. And she was blown sideways when beautiful Violetta wanted to be friends with her. She couldn't believe it. Violetta made the overtures, didn't she? We've got so much in common. Think about it. I could see her rolling through the history, realising how Violetta had played her chubby sidekick Delphine before she turned all that charm on Gretchen. Violetta, did you pick the dresses and charge them to her? She probably thought it was a friendly gesture, familial. But she was a size 42, and you're not.
Look, Delphine never meant to harm them. Gretchen was on her feet. She was a good person. She was a good person.
Delphine never meant to harm them. I couldn't believe we were back here. What is wrong with you?
Gretchen was not only fooling herself, she was weeping with the strain of denying it all.
Delphine was so protective of me. Yes, she loved Violetta, but she didn't want me supporting them all. She was worried for me. She went crazy. It was so out of character. She poisoned the champagne. She killed them all. Theo was only trying to protect me. Why is everyone trying to protect you? You're a spoiled, shitless billionaire. She didn't like that at all.
Yes, Violetta took the Dana out and sank it. She did it for me, and I am grateful. She knew I couldn't live through another public scandal. I can't.
At that, Gretchen sank to the sofa, covered her face and sobbed.
Violetta sat down next to her, head tilted, rubbing Gretchen's back sympathetically.
Darling, no, murmured Violetta. Don't cry, please. If you cry, I'll cry, please.
I watched them and I knew that Gretchen was crying because deep down, she knew. The real Dauphine didn't poison anyone. She knew it was all Violetta, and she helped to cover that up because it suited her better than confronting Violetta, calling the police, sitting through a tawdry, exposing investigation and a court case that asked humiliating questions about her relationship with Leon, about his money. I spoke up. None of it was Dauphine. Violetta did it all. You know that.
Gretchen sobbed louder, trying to drown me out. She cried open-faced, her hands limp on her knees.
Violetta leaned towards her, holding her hands, nodding encouragingly. I saw now that Gretchen thought I was victimizing her by telling a truth she didn't want to hear. It made sense of the way she behaved during the rape case, and why she felt okay about trying to shut me up. Even now, even after the other girl and her attempts on my life, Gretchen still felt that I was attacking her. Self-pity makes tyrants. It's the defining characteristic of brutal regimes. But it was more than that with Gretchen. It was laziness, too. Violetta suited her, flattered her, coddled her. And Gretchen would harbour Violetta until it no longer served her to do so.
Poor Gretchen, I said.
You won't get to choose. She looked up at me, her face wet and red.
Choose?
Choose when it ends, with Violetta. She'll choose.
Gretchen looked at Violetta's hands cupped around hers.
I think you should shut up.
I didn't.
Does your will leave everything to Dauphine?
Gretchen flinched and shut her eyes. Violetta's back straightened and she looked at Scarface, trying to catch his eye, but he was looking to Gretchen and didn't see her. I carried on.
Violetta is Dauphine now. You vouched for her. She has Dauphine's passport, her identity, her life.
You know what she's planning, don't you?
Gretchen stood up and snarled at me.
You disgust me, you know that. Drunk in a hotel room with four men. What do you expect to happen?
She was trying to shock me, to stop me saying it out loud, but I've heard much worse.
She's going to kill you, you stupid, self-indulgent bitch.
I saw a flicker of terror in Gretchen's eyes. She knew I was right. She raised a hand and Scarface came for me. I was so shocked by the speed with which he moved that I spat in his face. Pink saliva and raspberry pips dripped off his scarred chin. Then I saw the gun in his hand. He was holding it by the barrel and he raised it over my head. One word, over and over again. That was all I heard before the blackness. It was Finn's voice and he was screaming, "No! No! No!" Chapter 49. I woke up. My head was so sore I couldn't open my eyes. I moved my fingers first, then my bare feet. Soft. A cool breeze brushed hair onto my cheek. I opened my burning eyes one at a time. The bedboard above me was grey silk. I was in the big bed in crisp linen sheets. I was alone. The windows were open to the rooftops of Paris.
I was back in our hotel suite. I tried to sit up, but an electric pain shot through my head, back to front, making me cry out and lie still. My eyes throbbed with pain.
Hello?
Finn was standing in the door.
God, how long have I been here?
A day. He sat on the edge of the bed. Awake some of the time.
A whole day?
I felt my head. There was an egg-sized lump on my scalp above my right eyebrow. It was hot to the touch.
You've been scanned for a hematoma, but they'll have to do it again.
He left pills for the pain. They're worried about a concussion.
Did it drop?
Finn slid his phone out of the breast pocket of his jacket and looked into the lens.
No. The live stream stayed up the whole time. We got everything. Scarface in vivid close-up, Violetta's confession, everything. But, he said seriously, it's not all good news. We lost a lot of numbers during the wait in the hall. They picked back up when you called Violetta out. Went stratospheric then. The cops were watching, and obviously when Scarface came in they were mobilised. He's already wanted by police forces in a number of territories. The police were waiting outside.
Outside?
Well, the maid wouldn't open the gate because they didn't have an appointment. They had to climb over the wall.
What happened?
Gretchen and Violetta were arrested by the French police for conspiracy to murder us, but the Italians want to interview Violetta about Julia. They've got CCTV of her passing Malik's store. The board of the football club have issued a statement saying the allegations about the stadium sell-off are unfounded, but the press are all over them. They're reopening the Dana investigation. I told them what Albert did at Skibo, but they said we'd need more evidence of a crime. You can't arrest someone for being a turd.
That seems unfair.
What are the numbers like? Millions. Trina Keeney's second. She wants to do a crossover podcast.
Let's do it. I like her. I was slowly becoming aware of noises in the living room, hissing and whispering and the distant growl of a TV. Finn saw me look towards it and smiled.
So, anyway.
Then he got up and walked out. Didn't even shut the door. But I was glad he didn't shut the door because I heard him say something and I heard squeals. I knew who it was. Jessica and Lizzie ran into the room and got into bed with me. They touched my lump and said it felt hot. I held on to them. I was crying so much that I made their little chubby hands wet. Lizzie thought I was crying because my head hurt and they took turns kissing my bump better, jabbing it with passionate little kisses, taking turns. It was incredibly painful. And I never wanted it to stop. With each kiss, I thought of Sabina's love for Amila, of my mum's love for my dad, and how close I came to suicide. Trina was right. It is a passing impulse, a signal that change is needed. If I had done it, I wouldn't be here, in a giant bed in Paris, having my sore face kissed by tiny lips. I was in the afterwards. It was glorious. And a lot of people didn't make it here. That is all I'm saying about that. There's been more than enough emotional stuff in this story, crying and despair and so on. Hamish was out there as well with Estelle. I was still angry, I was. But there are times in this life for hating, and this wasn't one of them. I was grateful to have such lovely people to be angry with. Maybe it was the bang on the head. The doctor was called back to the hotel room and his technicians used a portable scanner to check me for brain bleeds or clots. No sign of long-term damage, but we were to call if there were any changes. It was an amazing day. A day of amnesty. Finn ate. My girls were there. Hamish and I talked about all my lies and sadnesses, about my mum. She was kind and tall, and her face was mostly a glorious Persian nose, and she was terribly proud of it.
She liked gardening and omelettes and taught at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London, and she wrote books on genre and Middle Eastern poetry. She was amazing. I think part of the reason I ran away and never came back was that I couldn't deal with her death. And the attempt on your life, said Hamish, and the court case. I said, yes, that too. We sat on the bed together and talked about the court case, what was said, what they asked me. Hamish cried. He's a lawyer, and he cried over how they treated me in court. I found that very moving. He didn't mind that I had lied about everything. I apologised for thinking about killing him so much. He apologised for telling Estelle that I hit him. He said it was to excuse himself and malign me. He was sorry he'd been angry with me. He would come clean to Estelle. I still don't know if he has, though. You know, Hamish sounds like a prick in this book, but he isn't. He's the father of my children. He's a good father, and he has been a dear friend to me. We're both flawed. If he told this story, I might sound like a prick, or maybe a bigger prick than I already do. Finn went out for a walk with Estelle, and when they came back, he spent some time lying on the bed with me and we talked. He said she still loved him, but couldn't live with his illness. She wanted more from life, and he thought that was honest. I think his heart was broken, and I took his hand and told him kindly lies. It would be all right. The feelings would pass. He was still an attractive woman. We talked about Dauphine Loire and poor Mark Parker, both dead, and Leon. I didn't think Leon was my friend anymore. I knew he was dishonest and grasping, but he was also charismatic and charming, superficially lovely, and I like shiny things. But mostly we talked about the other girl, who she might have been, the astonishing courage it took for her to stand up when she'd witnessed what happened to me. What a hero she was.
I think we should find out who she was, said Finn. We should honour her.
I didn't know. I like to think of her as an unknown soldier, a symbol of all the girls who stood up, all those brave, bold girls who saw the girls before them crucified and spoke up anyway. Many were felled, and she stood for all of them. We watched cartoons on TV, ignored calls. We didn't need to speak to anyone else. We spent the evening all together. Everyone that mattered was in that hotel suite, and we knew it and were grateful for each other. Most people never get an hour like that. About 10 o'clock, the medication started to lift, the fog cleared, and I suddenly realised my situation. Oh, Christ. I had not been murdered. I was still alive. A doctor with a portable brain scanner and two technicians had examined me in a suite in the most expensive hotel in Paris. We were all staying here. I'd left Hamish's car in an airport short-stay car park for 5 days, and I had spent all of my cash running around Europe making a podcast, something with no discernible market value whatsoever. That could only mean one thing. I was gonna have to write this fucking book.
This has been a Hachette audio production of Conviction, written by Denise Mina, read by Kathleen McCarron. Conviction is also available in print and digital formats from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2019 by Denise Mina. Audio production copyright 2019 by Isis Publishing Limited. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales, is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.